Hello and welcome to the Raptor Show on the Sportsnet Radio Network, brought to you by Campbell's new Chunky Spicy Soup. It's time to get fired up. Make sure you find the Raptor Show wherever you listen to podcasts. Please rate and review the program. Subscribe to the show. I'm your host, William Liu. I'm continuing to be joined by co-host Blake Murphy. We are going to be changing time slots. This will be the last two-hour show of the season.
Was that a question?
For reasons that are pretty obvious, we are going to change time slots. We are going to be going to 11 o'clock Eastern, and we'll be going back from 2 hours down to 1 hour as well. So, Blake, how you feel about that, man?
Yeah, I mean, it's fine. Part of the reason is that the Blue Jays season is here. They start on Thursday. Mm. Kevin Gausman looking absolutely nasty in a couple spring training innings today in his spring training debut. So, yeah, that's part of it. And I mean, part of this programming note for me is that Jays Talk Plus is unofficially back. So there'll be podcast only episodes today and tomorrow. Jays Talk Plus will take place in the Raptor Show slot 11 a.m. to 12 p.m. on Thursday because it's opening day. Mm. I believe there's a day next week where I'm doing one of each back to back.
Oh, okay.
We're here. It's
So you're saying I got more time, free time, but you do not have more free time.
Correct.
You're telling me. Okay.
Correct. You saw the spreadsheets I'm working on upstairs. It's also fantasy draft season, which if you are like me, is a big couple of days. There's a little bit of money on the line, not to go all Shohei with it, but it's a big week here. It was a big weekend for Garrett Temple too.
It was a big weekend for Garrett Temple. Garrett Temple, you are the first Raptor to join us on back to back programs. I know obviously the last one was Friday, but welcome back, Garrett. How you doing, man?
I'm doing well, my guy. Appreciate y'all having me, man.
Yeah. Last time we interviewed you, obviously it was before the OKC game that you guys played on Friday. And we asked you, are you going to play tonight? And you gave us the quote that Darko tells people before the game, let you know if you're going to be in the rotation. So did he let you know that you were in the rotation for later that day when you played against OKC?
The OKC game, it was actually interesting. I wasn't in the rotation. And then it was one of those situations where coach looked down the bench. I think they went on a little run and he looked and he stood kind of next to me. And then he looked down and I think Scotty was next to me. He said, yeah, put Garrett in. And then coach was like, yeah, G, come on.
Okay.
And put me in.
Okay. So Friday,
that was a situation where he changed up that first half rotation.
This is great. Friday, you told us Scotty's coming along in that leadership role off the court and stuff, and now he's coaching. Like, we saw Kyle Lowry the other day.
Coach Barnes put you in.
Yeah,
huh?
Kyle Lowry, like Nick Nurse tried to put campaign in, and Kyle Lowry waved him back to the bench. Like, go sit down. We got Scotty doing the rotations and stuff now as well. So, Garrett, you played a lot of minutes. Like, you played, 29 minutes across those two games on a back-to-back. I know that you're still a professional athlete and you keep yourself in peak condition, but that's significantly more minutes than you've played most of the season. How'd you feel coming out of that back-to-back?
I didn't feel bad. Calf is a little tight, things of that nature, but in general I felt good during the games. We haven't had as many players to be able to play what we call conditioning games or play groups, so the guys that haven't been in the rotation playing games, kind of 5-on-5 scrimmages on game days. We haven't been able to do that for like the last 2-3 weeks. So, I've just been getting some sprints in, whether it be on the treadmill, just continuing to lift, and body felt pretty good afterwards.
Yeah, Garrett, I gotta let you know. First off, after the game, I always do a post-game review, and I hand out 3 stars for the game. You got my 3rd star for that one. That's totally unbiased, too, because you came in, me and Blake were watching it together.
It was a little biased when you and I were watching in the press box together.
We were hyped when you got in the game. We were like, oh, there's our boy Garrett. What's he going to do? And then one of the first possessions, you got on a Shea, like right away after coming in. And we're like, oh, no, this might be a problem. Except it's a problem for Shea because you actually rip Shea. And you got that steal there for one of your 2 steals. And you knocked down your 2 threes as well. And the whole time, we were just in the booth just like really enjoying the fact that, like,
yo, like, you plus came on 10 the program.
Plus 10 and a 20-point loss for the show's correspondent. Right. Yeah, that's a – I mean, damn. Like, look.
Coach Barnes should have played you more.
Individual plus minus is not the, you know, be-all and end-all, but you got to feel pretty good about, you know, the steals that Will mentioned, knocking down your couple threes. But, yeah, you guys won the minutes that you were on the floor.
Yeah, no question. At the end of the day, you want the team to play well when you're out there. Whatever, you know, whatever that may be, whether you're part of that or whether you're just out there and, you know, the other four guys are just doing great and you're not messing up. So individual plus minus, you know, you want the team to do well at the end of the day, especially a guy like myself, who's very, you know, team oriented, unselfish. It's not about scoring. It's not about me doing anything spectacular. I just want the team to play well and to flow, the game to flow well when you're in the game. So that was positive.
Yeah. Well, the next game against Washington, the night after, we figured you'd be in the rotation for that one. I just didn't think that they would use you basically as center. we got a small ball five on the pod. Tell us about that. I mean, man, yeah.
That was my first time, I guess, officially being the five, probably since like maybe elementary school.
Wow.
Maybe like first grade, second grade. but... You know, I know all the players from the five spot, and in today's game, you know, in a lot of offenses, the five is really the person that's setting the table. You know how we have KO, you know, making a lot of passes from the top of the key. You know, him and Jonathan have made some great assists, you know, over the last few games, as well as Yach when he was playing. So it's not as if I'm, you know, posting up and trying to get a bucket on the block, you know. So we're just trying to change things up. And, you know, I made a pick and pop three, which is great. But we're trying to figure out how to play with what we have. And I think I was, you know, zero plus minus. It was even when I was in the game. I let Marvin Bagley get an easy dunk on me. But other than that, I think we did pretty well.
Man, you hit a pick and pop three. It strikes me that, like you said, you're not going to run, you know, through the post. You're not going to run the offense through you in the post. But, like, we need a pick and pop version of the too small chirp, right? Like, if you had posted up Marvin Bagley and got one, you could give him the too small, even though he's big. We need a pick and pop version of that. I don't know what it would be, though.
Yeah, I don't know what it would be. I have no idea. I'm not, you know, God didn't give me the creative gene. So I have to ask one of my young players to figure out what that chirp would be.
Well, I mean, there was Scotty had one earlier in the year. Who was it? Drummond, where he mocked his, like, his upright running position after a bucket. That wasn't on a pick and pop, but, you know, some version of too slow, I guess, instead of too small. So Garrett, you just mentioned, you know, I brought up the plus minus first, and you just mentioned it again for the second game. And again, it's not the, you know, there's a lot of context in there, but I have been curious, you know, when you come back after a game and you individually or you guys as a team, what kind of numbers do come up in conversation? What do you look at in the box score? You know, whether in the box score or something, one of the assistants is tracking, what kind of numbers things is Darko bringing up, you know, at a halftime or after a game and things like that? You know, like, I know before it was a stat available on NBA.com, coaches would talk about, yeah, I got someone tracking deflections during the game and things like that. What are you guys looking at after game numbers wise?
Yeah, so we definitely look at deflections. You know, during the game, halftime, they have, you know, we have a number up there on the board. A lot of things that we look at is transition points. We look at turnovers, you know, points off of turnovers. Before we got in, before we were so, you know, decimated by injuries, we were looking at, you know, offensive rebounds. It's a little, you know, I guess a little less telling. I rebounded by like almost 20 last game in Washington, but they only had a couple of more, maybe three more shots than us. I think the big things right now are just transition points, how many we're giving up and how many we're scoring, and turnovers with obviously a whole new team. And Darko said it the other day, because he wants to be a team that, he wants to be the coach of a team that passes the ball a lot. We're going to have turnover. We're never going to have a game where we have zero or one turnover. So he's okay with that, but we can't have 25 or 20. Right. It has to be more like 10, 12. And when we do that, it's going to be in our DNA to pass. We're going to get a lot of assists and obviously less turnovers.
Yeah. So, I mean, it's been great to see you back in the rotation. It's been great to see you contribute. The team overall, though, 10 straight losses, and you know you have another chance to sort of crack that tonight against the Nets. But how do you, I don't know, how are you guys handling the fact that like you guys are on this losing streak and the situation is pretty difficult with obviously lots of players being out? It's not that the team is so, you know, down bad. It's just this, it's a difficult situation. How are you guys dealing with the fact that you guys are on a 10-game losing streak?
I've been on a few double-digit losing streaks before on different teams, and this, I can say, is the best vibe. I don't know if it's because, you know, we have a lot of injuries. We have guys out. So I guess the expectation isn't as high as other teams, maybe. At the end of the day, there's no excuse. You know, we're paid to play basketball and play at a high level, and we go out there to try to win games. Nobody's out here trying to lose. And as competitors, at the end of the day, intrinsically, we want to win. Mm-hmm. That's part of what makes these live sporting events what they are. You know, everybody is trying to win. And as competitors, it's tough, mm-hmm. Especially losing a game like in D.C., losing a game like in like OKC, when you're there, you know, you have one of, you know, team that's top three in the league and you know, wins, losses, and you're not able to get it done. And then in D.C., a team that's below you in the standings and you have a chance to win it in a close game and not able to get it done. So it's difficult, but that's the thing about this league. You have another one a couple of days later, if not the next day. And you just got to get back to the drawing board and try to figure it out.
So you said something within there that I think is helpful for fans to remember, is that the players are trying to win. No player is going out there trying to lose. And obviously, I don't know how much you're on, I don't know how much you're on Twitter, but I'm sure you understand the, you know, that certain fan bases or certain parts of the fan base are, you know, tanking this, tanking that. It's better to lose, whatever. And, you know, I'll put out an injury report and people reply tanking. It's like, okay, well, Scottie didn't like dislocate his finger because of tanking. He dislocated his finger because he dislocated his finger. What is that like on the player side? Like, how aware of that are you guys? How difficult is it to, you know, navigate that you guys are trying to win every game, but there's an understanding that, yeah, the organization probably doesn't care all that much about, you know, or in some teams in some cases might actually prefer to slide down the standings. What's that like for you guys?
Honestly, it's one of the most contradictory things in our sport. And it's a hell of a balance for the NBA in general, in my opinion. And for the specific team, you know, I haven't heard one time from our coach or our front office that we're trying to lose. I've been on teams where it was specific things that were happening where it was very obvious that we were trying to lose, you know, guys being very healthy and just not playing. Where in this situation, obviously, injuries have happened. Like you said, Yag didn't dislocate his finger or his ligament. Yeah, Sky didn't break his hand on purpose. The things that have happened in people's personal lives obviously didn't happen on purpose. So it's honestly, most guys, it's pretty easy just to focus because we've been taught to win and try to win at all costs. So it's not as if we're towing the line. I think the most difficult part is if a team is trying to kind of slide down those standings, it's probably more difficult on the coaches than it is the players. Because we're just out here trying to play and play as hard as we can and compete and try to win. Whereas the coaches may have to, you know, play certain guys, certain minutes and things of that nature. And as a player, you're looking at a coach and saying, what's up? We're trying to win games or what? So, again, in this situation, we're in a situation where nobody has shown me or obviously told me that we're not trying to win games. So, we just are in a tough spot in terms of how things have shaken out.
Yeah. I mean, you mentioned the previous spots where, you know, you've had instances where healthy players are rested. And again, you know, tanking is a reality of the league, even if it's not explicitly said. How do you get buy-in back in those places once you make the decision? You know what I mean?
It's difficult, man. It's difficult.
Because you can't just flip a switch of like, we're deciding to lose. Exactly. And now we have standards that we need to win.
Exactly. That's a great question. And I'm of the opinion of, you know, you can't just give players young players, you know, minutes just because I've always been of the opinion people have to earn their minutes, you know, and what Darko had Grady do. You know, Grady didn't just come in and just get minutes right away. You go to the G League, prove that you can play at a high level, you show growth, and then you get a chance. And if you take advantage of your chance, you get more. Whereas some teams and some organizations, we're just going to play the young guys no matter what. And if we lose, then that's even better because we'll get a better draft pick. I don't like that. And most of the teams, the couple of teams that I've been on that had that mindset, they didn't get any buy-in from the players specifically. And honestly, that front office is not there anymore. So it's difficult to get buy-in back. I think from the players or the coaches, honestly, because at the end of the day, we're all competitors and we want to win games. And the fans, at the end of the day, they want to see a product of people playing hard and winning. And if things shake out to where you don't win games, okay, you may have a chance to get a great player. But at the end of the day, especially for our fans, you want to put a product on the floor that people are proud to say that that's my team no matter win or loss.
So obviously, you know, a part of that is also, hey, Jamias Ramsey's going to start this game and it's the last game on his 10-day. Like, obviously that guy wants to win and wants to do everything. I know I asked you a little bit about the 10-day guys, the G League call-up guys today. So I apologize for doing this again, but I did talk to Jamias on Friday. He spoke really highly about being able to pick your brain a little bit during his 20 days with the Raptors. You know, the Raptors decided not to continue on with him, at least for now. Kobe Simmons is up with you guys for the next 10 days now. Did you have a conversation with Ramsey when that decision came down? Have you gotten a chance to talk to Kobe yet now that he's with you guys?
I haven't had a chance to talk to JR. I'm definitely going to reach out to him. And no need to apologize. Again, I love my story. I love how I got here. I talk about this all the time, just to have people have a mindset of a 10-day guy, because a lot of times we're, as NBA players, we're too entitled and we're not as grateful as we should be for the position that we're in. But I did talk to Kobe today during shoot around, and you know, I told him how I joked with him about his high school mixtape, because when I saw him coming out of high school, I was like, this guy is going to be cold. His change of pace, his ability to, you know, shoot, score, handle the ball. But yeah, I'm definitely going to continue to be in his ear. He's our point guard for the second unit right now, so he's going to have a lot of people in his ear. So I'm just going to let him soak it all in, and then you know, give my tidbits and let him know I'm an ear if he needs me. And I've been in the same situation he's in multiple times, as we talked about last podcast.
Yeah, that's a top 20 recruit at a high school.
I got to check out the high school mixtape. I wasn't familiar with this high school game.
He was cold, man. It was his change of pace. He was real smooth,
yeah,
quick. He was like Ja back, like in high school. Like, okay, that's the type of game he had. Yeah. Right.
I'm definitely seeing this mixtape. Okay, well, speaking of someone's mixtape that I've seen quite a number of times, it's time to ask about another one of your former teammates, Vince Carter. So obviously everyone in Toronto knows what Vince did, especially in his prime. You got to be teammates with Vince in Sacramento, and I understand that you guys golf and you guys are, you know, you got a lot of friends around the league, but it's gotta be cool being friends with Vince. What was it like being his teammate, especially at that time in his career where he had pivoted to, you know, being more of like a rotation guy, veteran voice, but at the same time you knew what he was back in the day, and I'm sure lots of players saw Vince and was like, yo, that's Vince, even though he's like the H man. Yeah.
No, I've told people this, whoever would listen. Vince Carter, there are two people that are the most down to earth superstars I've ever met in my entire life. Vince Carter and Penny Hardaway. And Vince being his teammate, man, just such a open book. Whatever you wanted to know, he's willing to tell you. We played a bunch of golf together, obviously. We played against each other when he was in Memphis. And obviously before, you know, when he was, I don't know where he was at, maybe I might have been in the league when he was in Dallas, but for sure a lot. We played against each other, matched up against each other in Memphis. And I just picked his brain about, you know, his regimen and all of that stuff. And obviously we connected, like I said, on golf. We went to Hawaii. I went with him with his fam to Hawaii, and we played in the summertime. We still stay connected today. He's playing golf almost every day now, which okay. I'm jealous of. But it was just amazing to see his how humble he is. Signs every autograph. Just a very nice guy. And I obviously talked to him about his time in Toronto and how crazy it was.
Right.
How the fans are amazing and how it must have been amazing while he was there. But it was great. And it's like you said, you know, when he got the Hall of Fame, you know, pick, me, him, George Hill, and Justin Jackson have a group chat.
Okay.
So we always hit each other up. We play together in SAC, and we really tight to this day. We all hit him up and told him, you know, congratulations, old man. But VC's one of my, it's crazy for me to say he's one of my, you know, best friends I've had.
Wow.
As a teammate. And then, you know, from then on, great guy.
I'm happy you guys did talk about Toronto a little bit, because I always wondered with Vince, like, is this still a bit of a sensitive subject? You know what I mean? Because it's like, obviously he took Toronto to like the very, very high heights, like arguably like the biggest heights that Toronto's ever been in before the championship. But I know it kind of ended in a way that wasn't pretty. And I know that there was like a lot of returns to Toronto where he got booed quite heavily and all that kind of stuff. And I'm sure there's like some fault to go around either side. I wasn't really there for it. But I guess, is it a sensitive subject for him to talk about Toronto?
Not with me. It wasn't a sensitive subject. Okay. It wasn't a sensitive subject. You know, people brought it up and he talked about it, guys on the team. And a lot of guys didn't even really know, you know, that it was kind of a non-amicable breakup. It's interesting. I saw on Twitter the other day, his first two times back in Toronto when he was with New Jersey.
And that was vicious, man.
He was cooking. Yeah.
He was cooking.
Hit a game winner.
Yeah.
Those were vicious, and then his game was vicious. He doesn't seem to have any ill intent at all towards the city, and talks about it very highly. So
That's nice.
Toronto, y'all should be probably welcome Vince back with open arms.
I mean, I think he's going to be like the first Raptor, or his first player to go in the Hall of Fame as a Raptor. And I know it's not like baseball where you like literally put a hat on or something and like you're...
Yeah, on your bust at the Hall of Fame. They're like there's like the little likeness of you, and they put the logo on your...
But
on
still,
your hat.
That would be like the first player where it's like, oh, that's a Raptor.
Yeah.
Going to the Hall of Fame. With all due respect to like Hakeem or whatever. People forget Hakeem was problem with the Raptors.
Like, Vince for sure put Toronto on the map for basketball. That was, You think about Vince Carter, you think about the Toronto Raptors for sure.
So you are, what, 37? Vince is, you know, a decade older than you. You've got Justin Jackson in this group chat. By the way, we got to get him another 10-day. I know his 10-day just wrapped with the Wolves a couple weeks ago. We get him back to the league, killing in the G League. But so you have kind of these couple generations. And when you played with Vince, you were, you know, a vet, but still, you know, not the level of vet that Vince is. And there were these young guys coming up. And I guess I'm curious, you know, when you look at kind of the multi-generation like that, and I know Justin Jackson went to UNC, so maybe it's a little extra for him and he's not the best example, but how much or where is the line did you find that like players are like, oh my God, that's Vince Carter. Like I'm playing with Vince Carter. Vince Carter's calling my game. Is that still there with guys who are in the league today, or is that kind of, you know, is that generation more like mine and your generation of like, oh my God, that's Vince Carter?
I think it's more mine and your generation, honestly, which is crazy because Justin has to be about at least 27 now, I would imagine. I don't think he's more than, he might be 26. But it's interesting. Like, I don't know if Grady would be in all events as much as, you know, I think about what
you
got to
put him on,
said,
man.
I think about what Brandon Miller said when he talked about Paul George being his GOAT, and I'm like,
what?
PG, like, not to take anything away from PG's game. It's crazy.
Yeah.
But just in terms of the age, I'm like, wow, PG, you know? Not KD, you know what I'm saying? Paul George. So with that being said, it's probably anybody 26 or over, 27 and under, I should say 27 and under.
Yeah.
26 and under. They won't understand the impact that Vince Carter had on the game.
That should be Darko's next film session, man. Just show him the Vince Carter like 20-minute highlight clips.
Grady's gonna be watching like Jason Capone clips instead of how do I get open relax. For this long two.
He surpassed Jason already, man.
This long two.
Yo, that's so funny. You ever look back on your? I mean, I'm sure you got in a little bit of this, but like that whole era where everybody was just coming off a screen and then taking a mid-range jumper, like that Rip Hamilton, like the amount of points you guys left on the table, man.
We talked about with me and James, our coach Coco.
Yeah.
We talked about the mid-range twos and how. And the Rip Hamiltons. And when I first got to DC, I wasn't a great 3-point shooter. When I got to Washington, Sam Cassell was my coach.
Yeah.
Lived in the mid range.
Yeah.
Come down on pull up mid ranges and, you know, fast break. And he was like, gee, instead of shooting a three, just when they swing it, step in. Mm-hmm. No dribble, just step in and take a midi. And I used to do that.
Yeah. Yeah.
And nowadays somebody would look at, I'm just thinking,
yo, they'll bet you for doing that.
Seen as like, what the, they call it travel or something. Something would happen. The world will blow up if somebody, a guard shot a spot up 2-pointer. That would be so interesting to see.
Yeah.
Oh, man. No, that's how Twitter would go crazy.
I feel like a lot of people left a lot of points on the board.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
And now it's like obviously the mid-range being dead is exaggerated, but now it's like it's superstar territory, right? It's like, if the defense is taking away the paint and getting up on you to take away your three, then right. The mid-range becomes really valuable. Like KD mm-hmm. can shoot that. Brandon Ingram shoots it a ton. Kawhi shoots it a bunch. But
Kyrie.
Yeah.
Those guys.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, Garrett, that's a good question because you never see the Raptors really take the mid-range. I'm sure Darko probably doesn't want you guys
to. One of the lowest mid-range rates in the league.
Yeah. Who's got the best mid-range game on the Raptors?
Oh, no, that's a great question.
Because we don't get to see it.
You guys don't even warm it up pregame when you're all doing your shooting stuff.
Oh, who got the best one?
The best mid-range is Gary Trent.
Jr. Gary Trent. Okay. Okay. All right.
G Trent. Yeah.
Yeah. He does take them sometimes. Yeah.
He takes them. And they're tough, but he makes them. So. It's one of those guys like, okay, knock it down, G.
I feel like
that's one of those good make. Get back on defense.
I feel like with Gary, that mid-range jumper is easier for him than the transition layup, man. I swear this guy. He has a couple 3-on-1s that I'm like, hey, should be a layup.
Hey, but we watched in the film today.
Okay.
You know?
All right.
I think the one that he missed, maybe it may have been a little personal. Him and then he would kind of jaw him before he got the one and he bumped him and missed it. But he had a nice finish.
He did.
I think a couple of possessions after that. So he's good on that one.
That's a random beef, man. Well, what were they beefing over, man? What were they talking? Do you ever get in the game and you just trash talk just for fun?
Nah, G is not a guy that trash talks.
Okay.
Trash talks, but he doesn't back down.
Right.
But certain guys rub you the wrong way.
Yeah.
Denny Abdia, you know. Maybe one of those guys.
Interesting.
So,
all right.
Yeah.
We got to, you know what? That's for next week. I'm going to ask you a list of guys that rub players the wrong way, you know?
Hey, I mean, Dennis is back tonight. And we asked Dennis a bunch of times on this show about, like, he's one of the kings of that. Like, he gets into it with everyone. I'm curious. Do you think it'll be a little spicy with Dennis tonight?
I expected it to be more spicy last game.
Okay.
I definitely feel like he's going to test Javon. I think Javon's starting for us tonight.
Okay.
I think he's going to test him tonight, but we'll see. It might be a little more spicy. You know, he didn't have a great game. He wasn't able to like get started at all. So we just got to keep him at bay. But because if he starts scoring and hitting some threes and getting to the rack, it's going to be a long night in terms of trash talk.
Yeah, can't let FIBA Dennis get going. We've seen that too many times.
Exactly. Garrett, when you hit that three on Dennis, I need you to hit the freeze on him one time, okay? Just tonight, please. It's my one request.
I got you.
All right, Garrett, I appreciate you spending time with us again, man. Thank you.
Thanks, y'all. Appreciate it, fella.
Garrett Temple. Man, honestly, a lot of good insight on that one.
Yeah.
Danny Avdija being an agitator, all right, taking notes on that one. Gary Trent's got the best mid-range game in the game.
Not surprised. And he's basically the only guy on the team that takes that.
He does have a decent mid-range game.
Coming off of those pin downs and getting into that kind of like one big dribble to the side, I mean, Redick always did it from the three, but that come off, catch, one extra dribble to create the space into that elbow extended jumper, like that's That's pretty much the only action the Raptors really run in the mid-range. Everyone else curls off of that and comes up to pass the three-point line redirects to the rim, the Bruce Brown.
Well, something that Grady used to do, he's doing better of it now because he's actually getting to the threes and he's coming off those screens and he's actually knocking them down from three. But I feel like early in the season, he would curl in the mid-range, and it was a little bit more comfortable of a shot for him to take some of those mid-range fades.
And it depends how someone's guarding you, too, right? Like, if you're getting top-locked because you're a three-point shooter and they don't want you running off the three-point line for movement threes, mm-hmm. you know, that's going to be there. And more often than not, you think, you're getting top-locked, so the back cut's there to redirect and go to the rim. But if they're just kind of like running you over the screen and cheating over the screen to the three-point line, that little in-between might be there. You got to make that read like instantly make the pass off of that or like get the shot up quickly because the guy's going to recover for the rear view contest then. Right. And that's when the Raptors have historically always been pretty like Fred's really good at that. Hey, I'm going to go over this. And if the guy takes that and goes toward the paint, I'm going to be there for the rear view contest kind of reach around. Not the level of block of Garrett Temple's help out of the corner swat the other night.
I'm so happy he's playing, man. It makes these interviews so much better. I was like, you know what? Like, tell me what you saw in the game type of deal, you know?
You know who is second to... Actually, no one with any sample has like any amount of mid-range attempts on this team. So it's a bad question. But do you know who is second after Gary Trent in how often they shoot in the mid-range this year?
This is like percentage of their shots, like the share of their shots from the mid-range?
Yeah, and like proper mid-range, second box, the like actual mid-range.
Second box. Sorry, man.
So it was...
I love Thorpe, but second box is one of the funniest terms.
It was Dennis before he got traded.
Yeah, right. Dennis used to have that little midi.
Yeah.
Who's second on the team? That's a great question. Okay. Not quickly. Quickly, very much a threes.
Quickly's fourth.
Okay. Scotty?
Yeah.
Yeah. Scotty does take a lot.
9% of his field goal attempts are the longer mid-range. And again, like we were talking about, that's a lot of like, that's the only thing a defense is going to let a star get, right?
Yeah, right.
Grady's third, by the way.
Okay. Yeah, you remember when second game of Scotty's career, it was in Boston, and the Raptors won in Boston.
Yeah, against Horford, he hit it, right?
He hit a whole bunch of those mid-range jumpers, and we were like, whoa, like, hold on, there's something like here. And obviously there was something here. He won Rookie of the Year and, you know, it's turned into an all-star now. But like, yeah, I mean, I think that they've definitely worked to expand his range, but I wouldn't even mind if he took more mid-rangers, you know? But I mean, yeah, I really miss Scotty, man. Like,
yeah,
these games are just not as compelling. No offense to everyone else, but it's not the same.
Yeah.
But, yeah. Scotty Barnes is all-star.
He is.
Yeah. That's when the season peaked. I'm not even kidding.
Yeah, I mean, we'll do that toward the end of the year. The highlights are like dark. Like we could do your three stars and Gerald Henderson for the season.
Oh, that's a good idea.
And like Darko's rant is definitely a three star in there somewhere. We got a little bit to talk about still from the Thunder and Wizards games. So let's take a break in there, and then we'll do that.
Cool. All right, well, we're going to take that break. Thank you once again to Garrett for joining us on the program back to back. And I've been your host, Willow. You've been listening to the Raptor Show on the Sportsnet Radio Network, brought to you by Campbell's new Chunky Spicy Soup.
Diving deep into Leafs, Raptors, Jays, and NFL. The JD Bunkus Podcast. Subscribe and download the show on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to the Raptor Show on the Sportsnet Radio Network. I'm your host, Swim Lou. Big thanks once again to Garrett Temple for joining us on the program. Blake Murphy, what's going on, man?
Not much.
Take Blake.
Pardon?
One take Blake.
Yeah.
Some really good ads coming your way. I love those ads, man.
Sure.
Yeah. One take, though. One take. Because it always takes me like five or six, though. So.
Nah. One take for those. One take for the little pregame TV hits.
Yeah.
I'm not trying to waste my time.
Oh,
get in, get
fair
out.
Fair enough, man. This guy just wants to maximize.
I don't get paid per take. I get paid for a completed read or segment.
You want to talk Raptors Thunder, Raptors Wizards, the two games that took place over the weekend?
Yeah, I mean, I have a little bit from those games, but I wanted to ask you first. So the only talking point really coming out of Saturday's game and yesterday's news was that the Raptors decided not to continue on with Jamias Ramsey at this point. So Ramsey did two 10-day contracts. And for anyone who doesn't know, after two 10-day contracts, you can't sign a guy to a third. You have to sign them for the rest of the season or let them go. So in the case of Ramsey, he'll go back to OKC's G League team. There's only two games left in the G League season for most teams. So kind of he'll be sitting around waiting for another call. Doesn't mean the Raptors can't revisit him later, whether after the Kobe Simmons 10-day or in the offseason or something like that. Mm-hmm. But for now, they have made the decision to move off of Jamias Ramsey and sign Kobe Simmons out of Raptors 905 to a 10-day. I obviously have some thoughts on this, being that these are my my G League guys. Kobe Simmons is a G League sicko like me. Like, he's played almost 200 G League games over six seasons. So, you know, I am familiar with your game, Kobe Simmons. Uh-huh. But Will, your take on this, because I did see some people a little surprised that Ramsey didn't stick around given what he'd shown over those 20 days.
Yeah, I mean, I think for the Raptors, it's just a chance to, number one, reward another guy who's spent a lot of time, honestly, in a difficult season with the 905 as well. The 905 are very similar to the Raptors in that sense. You know, both sides are struggling. I think the other thing, too, is just, like, you know, you get another chance to look at a different guy potentially in your system. It's not like Jamias was, like, undeniably better than, like, the whole field. You know what I mean? Like, I thought he came in, he acquitted himself well in certain areas. We saw that he can guard. We saw that he was athletic, long arms, you know, can get to the bucket a couple of times. It was great to see him knock down some threes, which was great. I still have questions about the three, but ultimately, you know, he came in and did his job, and the Raptors have another chance if they choose to circle back to him. So it's not the biggest news to me, but at the same time, I guess I am curious to see, you know, what else. Is it interesting to you that they keep trying different point guards?
Yeah, I mean, calling Jamias Ramsey and Javon Freeman Liberty point guards is a little generous at this point.
Sure.
And this is where, you know, I wrote about Jamias Ramsey Saturday after the game, because I talked to him a little bit, talked to Garrett about it a little bit. Just kind of like, you know, these usually 10 days come up and, like, they don't even play, right? Like Nigel Hayes got his two threes in garbage time against the Knicks, and we never saw him again.
Oh, yeah, that's
Freddie
right.
Gillespie only got the play because it was like a nothing part of the season, and like they were so desperate at center. Like, usually 10 days come up and it's like, hey, let's get familiar with you as a person. Mm-hmm. Let's get you a G League game or two. Let's see how you fit and what the vibe is. So for him to get to come in and play, he ended up playing 121 minutes, which is pretty significant for a guy in a 10 day.
So, his chance for sure.
In writing about this, basically what I said was, in a vacuum, I think Ramsey showed enough. You know, the he only hit 27% of his threes, but that number is up around 40% in the G League, and almost all of that is on the more difficult above the break threes. I think he's very physical and tough defensively. I think he does some things getting, you know, at least 1 foot in the paint, kind of attacking from the second side against closeouts and things like that. But if there were, you were going to make a case to not keep Jamias Ramsey, it would hinge on, Ramsey's also only 22, by the way. He was like one of the youngest players in his draft class coming out. So even though he's kind of a known commodity, maybe there's a little bit of developmental runway left, whereas Kobe Simmons is 26 and has six G League seasons and stuff. Anyway, if you were going to make a case against Jamias Ramsey, there would be two cases to make. One would be that, position and role-wise, he's a little redundant with Javon Freeman Liberty. They're both 6 foot three, kind of scoring, slashing two guards who aren't really point guards. Javon's a little ahead of him with the point guard skills, but neither is really a point guard. And the second would be that, well, hey, Emmanuel Quickley's still out. DJ Carton's still out, who was supposed to be in this mix as a point guard as You don't actually have a point guard on the roster. So maybe just getting a look at an actual, like a more natural point guard makes some sense. And Kobe Simmons is more of that, you know, typical point guard than Ramsey and Freeman Liberty are. So, you know, and he's also bigger. So even if you didn't want to play him in that position, you could use him a little more interestingly. But, you know, this is a guy who's like regularly averaged 5-6 assists in the G League.
Yeah, yeah.
He's not going to come in and, you know, be Jose Calderon with the assist to turnover ratio or anything like that. He's, you know, more nominally a point guard than these other guys. So those are kind of the two things that were working against Ramsey. I do think, you know, in these 10-day situations, it's also important for your job opportunities in the league as a whole, right? Like, this gets him one or two more teams calling for summer league, interested in getting him in. He still has a year of two-way eligibility left. Maybe someone saw enough to consider him for a two-way this offseason. Maybe a European team was like, man, you get to the FIBA three-point line, and we really like what he does defensively. So I think it's still a win for him, even though he didn't get another look here.
He got 2 10-days and played a ton of minutes, as you mentioned.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And, you know, who knows? Maybe Kobe Simmons doesn't play that much. Kobe Simmons has had 3 cups of coffee in the NBA already. This will be his fourth different season coming in and playing in the NBA. But, yeah, I think that's kind of what worked against Ramsey. The a little bit of overlap role-wise with Javon Freeman Liberty, who's already in the system and signed through next year on a light guarantee.
Right.
And then maybe they just want to look at, hey, can we get a point guard for that second unit to organize a little better?
Do you think that it's because the Raptors have made a lot of these like signings out of the G League that are at either you want to call them point guard or like an off guard, whatever you want to say, but guards essentially, four guys now that they've tried. Is that sort of like, is this a bigger part to find, I suppose, a backup or even a third string point guard?
Yeah, I mean, you need to at some point. Like, one of these guys, like, even if DJ Carton is, you know, it's weird because Carton and Mogay are on two-way deals. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, technically, you know, you've already got two of your two-ways locked in for next year, including a point guard. The way it works out is two-ways, guys almost never make it to the end. Yeah, like Jordan Lloyd asks for a release, or you decide a guy hasn't shown enough developmentally and there's no downside to a team cutting a two-way and moving on. I think they're searching for that. I think also just the way the roster is structured right now, you could have made a case that maybe you could have used this 10-day on a center because Jonte's away from the team and Jakob Poeltl's out for the, but like,
You got Garrett Temple now. You're good.
Right. You also have your two centers locked in for next year. Jakob Poeltl and Kelly Olynyk are both under contract. You only have one point guard locked in for next year at the NBA level. So I think it makes sense to, you know, try Carton, Javon, Jamias, Kobe Simmons. You know, I had a small list of G League point guards from other teams that, you know, probably either ended up getting the he's too small or he's too old kind of tip.
NBA GMs being like,
Yeah, like, look, if you're too a G, and since the introduction of two-ways and they expanded to three two-way spots per team, the point guard used to be the deepest position in the G League where, always find Archie Goodwin. Like, there was always that guy available in the G League, and now it's a little tougher because most teams keep a point guard on one of those two-way spots, so the good point guards in the G League tend to be on two-way deals. So it's a little thinner. I also think the organization, especially in a year like this where, like, nobody in the G League is like that obvious a standout. And even the teams that have signed guys out of the G League, you know, only a handful of those have converted that into real deals. A lot of teams have been doing the 10-day churn. I think it makes a lot of sense to reward your guys internally, even though it's been a bad year for the 905, so that the next time a guy's trying to decide, should I go to Europe? Should I stay in the G League? Should I sign with the Raptors for summer league and training camp? Or should I sign with the Kings? The Raptors can say, well, look it, man, we rewarded Justice Winslow with the 10-day. Mogay got a 10-day and then a two-way. Kobe Simmons got a 10-day and so on. And you can at least show that, hey, financially, if there's opportunity, there's NBA opportunity there too. Right. But financially as well, you know, like the G League guys only make $41,000 for the year. If you can show we have a track record of, we're not going to guarantee you this, but we have a track record of making sure our guys get taken care of when the opportunity is there, I think that's a non-zero factor as well.
Yeah, like what do you get off a 10, like a 10-day? Like roughly like 160 now?
Yeah, I mean, it depends on your level of service time.
But you could easily quadruple your salary if you have one 10-day. You know
So like Kobe Simmons is what? This is his fourth year, so he'll make that's not right. Sorry, give me a sec.
No, it's all good. It's all good because I think to your point.
So he'll make $120,000.
Yeah, exactly.
On this 10-day because he's got 3 years of experience.
For sure. It makes the whole season worth it. Something I think that is going to be a question for a lot of Raptor fans is next season going to be worth it? Because I think for a lot of people watching this, and everyone understands that they're in a difficult situation. We already talked about it, but the injuries, the personal situations, the trades that took place mid-season, like whatever, this year ended up being kind of a wash. But the question on a lot of Raptor fans' minds is just, when is this team going to be good again?
Are you asking me that right now?
I'm asking that question.
Okay. Well, I mean, the optimist view is next year. And if you are someone who wants to keep the pick this year, that preference, to me, hinges a lot on how good you think this team's going to be next year. Because if you think the Raptors are going to be this same level of competitive next year, you should probably not want this year's pick, given how good next year's draft is, the fact that you already have two picks in this draft outside of your own first. And then, you know, if you don't think this team's going to be good at all and you're potentially in the mix for a top five pick again, that's more attractive next year. Having said that, if you think, well, look, Scotty looked really good and maybe he can take a leap to that next step to fringe all NBA instead of just all-star. Hey, Emmanuel Quickley was figuring some things out before the personal situation. Maybe he looks like that all of next year. RJ looked really good in Toronto. Maybe that's real. And then you add in, you know, a top six talent from this draft. And it's like everyone you talk to says, yeah, it's a weaker draft at the top, certainly, but it's still, like, bad drafts produce good NBA players all the time. And you add another one of those guys to this young core, you also have a lot of cap flexibility this year, especially depending on the decisions you make with Gary Trent and Bruce Brown. Mm-hmm. you know, this could be an offseason where you add a piece or two as well. And then you're talking about, well, next year the goal should at worst be get back into the play-in and win the play-in and get to the postseason. In terms of how long the path is to actually like contending meaningfully again, some of that's going to depend on Scotty's timeline. Some of that's going to depend on how they hit on these things. The tough part is if you decide that you want to be competitive again in a meaningful way next year, you keep the pick this year, you use the, you know, maybe you trade one of the other picks, whatever, you use that cap space. Well, you're not going to have another high pick anytime soon if things go well, and you're not going to have cap space anytime. This is your cap season. So if you believe that this is a, like, you got to hit every little note this offseason in a way that they haven't quite hit the last couple off seasons. Mm-hmm. So there's certainly a path to where they're solid again next year and competitive again next year. The path to being like second, third round of the playoffs again anytime soon is a little tougher.
Yeah.
But that's kind of what the timeline looks like. You just got to make sure you hit all this offseason stuff, because if you try to make that jump and you whiff on some of these moves, it's a long way back.
Because I think, so it depends on obviously what your definition of watchable basketball is, or like what's good.
Oh,
again,
they'll be watchable again. Like if you drop Scotty back in this team, that's enough to be watchable. Like, they're not the Brooklyn Nets if they're healthy.
No, for sure. I think there's certainly the hope, right? Because you need to, if you're not necessarily just already winning games, you need to sell hope.
Yeah.
So at least when you see Scotty and you see some of these other young guys come back into the squad, you can at least see hope and you can enjoy the process of it, even if they don't necessarily win. Obviously, they would go a long way in terms of pushing them towards winning. The other thing is like, well, if we're really going to do, like, what's the point of taking a one-year hit? Why not take a two-year hit? Because the pick is only protected for 2 years.
Yeah, I mean, the argument would be that,
like, if we took another down year next year, added two really high-end prospects, at that point, you know, obviously it's going to be difficult to see another season like this, but...
Well, you know, at that point, you're getting into, okay, well, Scotty's then into his max rookie scale extension contract.
That's fine. He's not
RJ's
going
a year closer to free agency.
I don't think he's going anywhere.
No, probably not. But you're asking the question, and this is why.
Yeah.
You have a fan base that's dealing with a third consecutive year of underwhelming performance. You also, like the more talent you add, the harder it is to actually execute that. Because, like, let's say that happens. Let's say you add a top six pick each of the next 2 years, and you've got Scotty and RJ and Quickly and whatever
else. All of a sudden, then I will feel like, wow, the talent base is actually quite strong.
Right. But then you try to look at that and say, okay, we want to lose one more year so that this pick becomes 2 seconds instead. That's a hard sell. That's hard culturally and developmentally. Like, I guess I don't see a scenario where if you're this bad this year, keep the pick, have a good offseason. You're that bad again next year, keep the pick, hit on the pick. Like, how, if you're still bad at that point, it means you've executed all of this really poorly.
Well, yes and no, because the roster structure of it is just not great. I mean, basically without Jakob Poeltl, they just don't win games. So if you found...
I mean, without Jakob Poeltl and Scotty Barnes and RJ Barrett and Emmanuel
Quickly, like, the record's
right
like 2-15. Even when they had Scotty and those other guys, they were losing when they didn't have Yak. So, like, again, this is unpleasant to think about, but if they actually did decide to take the bullet and do this again for the next year, they can actually easily execute that by just weakening one of their positions, most notably Jakob, who's the only guy who plays defense besides Scotty on this
team.
Yeah,
I just there is a real risk and cost to doing that, like,
yeah, no,
developmentally,
that's fair,
culturally,
for sure.
Fan base-wise. You know, then you're looking at Scotty as a number one guy has been in 3 years of losing situations.
Yeah,
I don't think you want... Unless you are going a full take it down to the studs mode, I don't think you want to plan for being bad for that long.
Okay.
I think you would rather...
So this is a blip.
Like, if it's one more year?
Yeah.
Okay, absolutely. But at that point, if you are still capable of being that bad, in my opinion, you've done a poor job developing, using the one summer of cap flexibility you have, hitting on those two picks, et cetera.
Right.
I don't see a twin track where you can amass talent and be successful with all these roster moves and still be top six pick level bad 2 years from now. It's tough to picture.
I think the ideal situation is like what kind of OKC went through, which is they had their star on the roster. They were still losing, but they were able to at least amass talent in the meantime. And then once they had all the pieces in the door, they can grow. Because I think the other concern is even when healthy, how good is this team? And does that warrant the need for more high end talent?
Yeah, I mean, we're not going to get to find that out. Is the unfortunate answer here?
That is the unfortunate answer.
Yeah, and look, man, I don't know how much tournament you watch. I'm not trying to look at prospects for 2026 just yet.
Okay, you know what?
It's not that dark.
You're right. We're at a pivot then. I'm going to take this break. I've been your host, Willow. You've been listening to The Raptor Show on the Sports Radio Network, brought to you by Campbell's new Chunky Spicy Stew. Yeah.
Breaking down the top stories in the NHL every day. The Jeff Merrick Show. Subscribe and download the show on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to the Raptor Show on the Sportsnet Radio Network. I'm your host, Wayne Blue. I'm joined by Blake Murphy, co-host, wearing the appropriate sweater for today. On the program, we got Sirisohi of Ringer.
You're asking me about 2026 Raptors picks. I'm talking 2025 WNBA draft picks. Let's go.
There you go. Sirisohi of the Ringer joins us once again. Sirit, I understand that you have been spending most of your time and attention on the women's tournament. How are you doing?
I'm good. How are you guys doing?
I mean, the Raptors are not great, but we're personally doing pretty well, actually. Yeah. But
yeah,
that's a healthy balance.
Yeah, you're scouting picks. You're scouting picks for for Toronto's WNBA team. I love it.
Yes, overreacting to two-game samples because, you know, no, I'm not as locked in over the course of the college basketball season. I dabble a little bit here and there. But, yeah, I'm wildly overreacting to two-game samples. It's the best.
Yeah.
It's the most fun thing about sports, guys. Like, I for one, am really enjoying the fact that we don't get 82 games. We just have to go off of what we see and just spit out hot takes. That's what I'm here for. Mm. That's what Will's here for. It's what you're here for. So it's going
to
be fun.
Yeah. Well, we're going to move from Kobe Simmons hot takes to Caitlin Clark hot takes. And you wrote an excellent piece. I got to say, the piece was really, really good. And then I read the next piece that was in my Pocket app, and it was Wright Thompson's piece. I was like, this is not fair. It's just not fair. Are you personally burned as a writer to drop an excellent profile?
I imagine
profile?
It's probably like what it's like to guard Caitlin Clark, or what it's like to be like the second best player in the NCAA, right? Like,
yeah.
Who's number two, you know? And it's just you got to live with it. Honestly, Wright Thompson's piece on ESPN, which was excellent, and on it, like one of the best pieces of sports writing that I've read all year, was a form of inspiration for me. It kind of helped me get over the finish line with my Caitlin Clark piece. So I think, you know, you got to learn, as we know in this business, where we are always kind of coming up against our colleagues who are so, so talented. Mm-hmm. You have to learn to turn your jealousy into admiration and wonder. Otherwise you're kind of screwed. So I was able to do that. And I'm just glad, like, that piece was awesome. And we got to learn so much about Clark and how she's just kind of like, she's like a Jordan level of intensity, competitiveness, commitment, desire. And you know, anytime, you know, Wright Thompson, just, he's so good at getting down to the sort of inner workings of athletes that we just don't never really get to take the mask off of. So I'm happy that piece came out.
Yeah, there's like therapy sessions in there.
Yeah,
like, it's that 76 minute read. I was like, oh yeah, that's, I rubbed my hands. I was like, yep.
Also,
I,
like,
my next hour,
the way that a lot of people consume media now is like first of all, there are just like small pieces of it being snipped and passed around Twitter or whatever. And then, like, I'm sure there are a lot of people who like open it up, read, this is good, and then maybe just don't finish it or whatever. So, like, if you only read part of that piece, it's like, oh, Kayla Clark is like just like Kobe, just like MJ. In terms of being a ball hog, she's like, why would I pass to someone who's not getting as many shots as me up in the gym? And then, like, the part of the story is like, yeah, we had to try to like coach that out of her, like bring her along a little bit, become more of a team. So there are probably people who only got that part of it, and they're like, yeah, that's why she's good. It's like, no, actually being great was like being that, but also taking the next step in terms of how to be a leader and how to be, you know, a good teammate and bring others around you along as well. Now, Sarah, your piece was mostly about, you know, Caitlin Clark herself and the phenomena of this. And you had this great lead about, like, are we going to talk about Caitlin Clark in a way where people were like the next generation, like, okay, grandma, like we heard about Caitlin Clark. But really, how has your feeling been? Like we're obviously only one game into Caitlin Clark's last March Madness run here. They're playing tonight again against West Virginia. But how has it felt so far? Like, you got that piece, you know, leaves your hand. We get to see the first Caitlin Clark game. She struggles a little bit, but still puts up this monster near triple-double. How has it felt, this first kind of weekend of the Caitlin Clark March Madness?
Well, this is kind of it. It is a culmination of everything that she's been working on throughout her college career. I think, you know, they had this win against Nebraska to win the conference championship. And she basically said at the end of that game that there is no way that, you know, Caitlin Clark as a freshman or a junior would have been able to win that game. And it was kind of the same. That was the same feeling that I had in their game against Holy Cross. Now, granted, Holy Cross being a 16 seed, they probably would have found a way to pull that one out anyways. But the fact that it ended up being a blowout when it started off as a close game, and they were doing all of the things that you would have done against Caitlin Clark probably a year ago. And frankly, the things that you have to do against her now, because there are only so many ways that you can guard her. Because she's got the logo range, but she's also a three-level scorer and she's a great playmaker. And they were basically, they were doing everything. They were packing the paint at times, or other times that they were just basically trying to, like, they were guarding her out from the logo. They were switching, hedging very, very high. And, you know, to her credit, after some early turnovers, she was able to get the ball out of her hands and spray the ball to shooters in the corner, because, you know, something is going to be open when you have to put that much attention on her. And that, to me, is basically, like, the story on and off the court with her right now. Like, the attention that she's able to leverage for the sport, but also for her team itself. Like, how is that going to spray out in different ways? Like, who else, you know, beyond Caitlin Clark are we going to be talking about at the end of, you know, at the end of the tournament, because of the sheer amount of eyeballs that she's drawing, and the fact that, you know, that last game for Iowa, it was a difficult start, as far as, you know, you kind of expected one seed to just basically have their way with the 16 seed. But Holy Cross is a really good team. They're really good defensively. They can shoot with Iowa, and Iowa is the best shooting team in the league. They're the number one offense in the league 2 years in a row. They're 5 points better than they were last year. So they're kind of just, you know, as Caitlin Clark is breaking records, they're also sort of breaking their own records at the same time. But it's going to be like this going forward. They're playing West Virginia tonight. West Virginia's coach, Mark Kellogg, when they figured out that they were likely going to be playing Iowa if they won their first round matchup, which they did against Princeton, basically said, let's get this win and let's send Caitlin Clark home. Now, he has walked that back, because if there's another thing that we know about Caitlin Clark, is that you don't want to talk trash to her. Like, she's going to find a way to internalize that and increasingly find ways to actually be productive with it, as opposed to getting lost in her logo shots. And maybe that was kind of the play with what Kellogg was trying to do. But West Virginia has, they have the defensive player of the year. They have, or a candidate for defensive player of the year. They have an incredible backcourt. They do full court press. And, you know, it's just going to be a matter of how well does Iowa weather that, and then going forward, you know, they're kind of in the toughest bracket. They might play UCLA, LSU in the Elite Eight, one of those two teams who are incredible rebounding wise, and this is an Iowa team that struggles with size. So even just, like, getting back to the Final Four, that is going to be really tough for them.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think what you're really illustrating here is that, like, there are a lot of expectations now. I feel like, you know, in previous years there was definitely hype and excitement, and it's building. Now, when it becomes like a thing, right? Like, Caitlin Clark is the thing.
You're a one seed. You're the number one pick. You're getting the Sirit Sohi and Wright Thompson treatment. Like,
And now all of a sudden, everyone's now not just watching for the excitement and the thrill of, like, ooh, look how cool this is. It's like, I need to see you be, you know, to borrow the comparisons earlier, I need to see you be Kobe and Michael Jordan, like, every night. And that's what people are tuning in to see. And if you don't even come close to that, or if you don't do that every single time, then all of a sudden it becomes a disappointment. So how do you see this group handling that expectation, especially, obviously, Caitlin herself?
I think that's what all the therapy has been about, right? I think
that's been
a big part of what they've been trying to sort out, is how do they manage the pressure and the expectations that now come along with this attention. And I think that, you know, for Caitlin, it's something that I don't think there's anybody who is as hard on her as she is on herself. Like, if you watch that game, she's throwing the basketball against her head, you know, after missing shots. You know, she just couldn't get her three working for a little while there. So I don't think that that's necessarily going to be as big of a problem for her, because, you know, like, she is just one of those special people. It's what draws us to her. She can kind of communicate her desire, her greatness, and also just her ability to have these moments sort of glance off of her in these, you know, high leverage, high stakes, spotlight blaring in her face moments. And it feels like the people around her have done a really good job of learning how to manage that. It seems like just her parents have been great about it, her teammates, her coaches, who have, you know, seen this coming and are just really have tried to find a way to not necessarily shield her from everything that's going on, because I think that on some level, you can't do that. But to also find pockets of just allowing her to be herself, to like maintain a sense of wonder about life, about the game, that kind of allows you to just like take a step back and remember that it is just a game. Like, to me, she is kind of, I wrote this in the piece, but it's like, could we imagine if Pete Maravich in his time, he had a family foundation that was stable and was not like putting all this expectation on him? And that's kind of the case with Caitlin, where her parents are, dad, you've seen her on the, him on the screen, like he's very passionate, but these are Caitlin's dreams. She's the one who wants to be the greatest. She's the one who's put this on herself. And the other thing is, instead of, you know, back in the day where, you know, his athletes, they internalize all the pressure that they're feeling and all the expectations that they're feeling, Caitlin Clark has been open about talking about these things with the people closest to her, including the team therapist, including, like, you know, person that she sees and everything. So, you know, it's kind of, it's like a different age as well. It's like, would Michael Jordan have potentially figured out the things that it took him a while to figure out as well earlier in his NBA career, things that he kind of figured out with Phil Jackson that he never figured out with Doug Collins? But those things have happened earlier in this sort of like new age of, you know, just embracing mental health and, you know, just like what's going on inside of you, instead of like turning all those things into fuel or trying to do that, or, you know, what have you, like all the sort of cliches we have about those things.
Yeah. Well, that's the thing too, is just like, she is really comfortable, at least like competing in a level that sometimes, again, like when she's frustrated, like we saw in the first game, like she's yelling the refs. Her dad told her to shut up and get back to the game. She's throwing that ball off her own head. Like, but she's so comfortable in competing. Like, it comes, like the act of competition comes above everything else. There's no pretense to it in a way that I feel almost like, how is there any 21-year-old in the world who's comfortable, A, being themselves, right? That's a concept already is kind of shaky to me. Mm-hmm. And the other part,
like, who is yourself at that age, really, right?
Yeah.
Who's yourself at 37?
Frankly. Yeah. Like, I don't
sure.
know.
No, but then you see lots of athletes now where they're like, they're afraid to compete. Like, you even see, like, that's part of the reason behind, like, the dunk contest falling off. People just don't want to fail. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? They don't want to fail.
I mean, Jaylen Brown's quote about it, right? It's like, like, he did it, but the reason no one does it is because the risk is everyone clowns you. And like the upside is very limited.
For sure. And there's so much exposure now. I mean, everyone was on TV before, on radio, I guess. Now it's like you're on every single platform all the time. But she is just not, that's all somehow secondary. She like either compartmentalizes it or ignores it or just loves competing so much that it does remind me of that, like, you know, whatever Kobe ended up making himself into was kind of just like, okay, it's about competing more than anything else. And that was his whole ethos.
Yeah. And I kind of think that compartmentalization is probably like the biggest skill you can have as like that elite level competitor, where at a certain point, like maybe not immediately after the game, but you have to be able to turn that off after a loss because it will eat away at you so much. If not, I'm like, yeah, we need a small element of, hey, that's going to fuel me. If I, you know, if they get bounced by LSU, say, and I do want to talk to you about LSU because they, Kim Mulkey's continual stepping, not even stepping on rakes, but like sharpening the points on rakes and then laying them out for herself to stomp on. So we'll come back to that. But like, let's say LSU beats them, you know, how does that contribute to the Caitlin Clark story in a way that kind of fuels her? And that tells the next story about, you know, hey, she improved this part of her game that got her in the gym and stuff, but it doesn't bleed into the off court side where, hey, this is a real, you know, problem for me personally, because I'm defined by the level of competitor that I am and I didn't get it done. I guess I don't really have a question from that, Sirit, other than, you know, how curious are you about what failures, maybe not the right word, but they are the one seed. So let's say they come up short. How curious are you about, you know, what the response to that will be from Caitlin Clark and how that will kind of dictate where her story goes from here headed into the WNBA?
Yeah, I think the thing that you're talking about right now is basically like, do you have an on switch and do you have an off switch, that stuff? And I think that Caitlin has always had the on switch. She has needed it. Like, this is somebody who has been basically complained about by parents for, you know, kicking their son's butts in, you know,
that's right.
And then, you know, has been getting overrated chants since she was in high school. She had entire arenas booing her last year. And what did she do? She cupped her ears against them and told them, basically get louder. Like, I can take this. Like, I will turn this into greatness somehow. Like, I will use this as fuel. It reminds me of Trae Young when he was at Oklahoma. It reminds me of Trae Young against the New York Knicks a couple years ago. Just that ability to alchemize those things. But the other thing that you saw with Trae Young for a long time, and I think it's something that he's getting better at, is his inability to trust his teammates. And that sort of, like, being able to have that on switch and learn how to turn it off at the right moments is basically what she spent the last 4 or 5 years figuring out how to do. So I think that at this point, going into the WNBA, I just don't see a way that she wouldn't continue to go down that path. Like, that's also a testament. Like, I just have a lot of faith in her and her ability to do that. And it's also in, like, you know, Will, you mentioned people don't want to put themselves out there anymore because they're afraid of not only failure, but the backlash that comes with it now in this, you know, age where, like, every athlete basically is, like, under the glare of the social media panopticon at all times. It's very different now, but she has also kind of, to me, in, like, these little moments, displayed, like, the vulnerability that it now takes in order to improve, to, like, try to do things that you're not very good at. In little moments, and just as far as, like, even the willingness to relinquish the ball when that's something that she wasn't always comfortable with, but also, you know, in ways of, like, completely getting off the ball, becoming a decoy, turning herself into a screener, which is not something that we see a ton of yet, but we have seen it in some pretty critical moments this season and sometimes last season too. And it's something I talked to her assistant coach at Iowa, Jan Jensen. She basically said, like, expect more of that as she goes into the pros. So she is, I think, on some level already preparing for what life is going to look like there. And if they lose, honestly, like, frankly, I feel like that's probably even more fuel. Like, going back to that, right, Thompson profile, when they lost to Creighton when she was, I believe, a sophomore, her brother sent her the scoreboard random moments of that summer, which is just so, like, that's emotional terrorism. But, like, she... he feeds off of it, you know? So I think, you know, she'll probably need more of a cushion this time because I think that the fit, like, the level at which she's under scrutiny now is so much higher. But I trust her ability to metabolize it into something great.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think that this is one of the parts that's really beautiful of basketball, really. Like,
what, siblings sending you negativity? Because I'm going to send you every negative tweet we got about the show. I'm going to send you that all off season.
No, I'll do the same to you as well. And I think what's really interesting about basketball is that, like, people come to watch, like, individuals perform. And the function of the sport is such that you could almost diminish anybody by virtue of how many guys you're committing or how many defenders or whatever scheme you want to put towards that one player. And that player eventually does have to then surrender almost a part of their ego to be like, well, winning is actually more important than whatever this service that I'm trying to be.
I mean, almost every MVP level scorer in the NBA has dealt with that. I can get 20, I can get 25, I can get 4 assists, but now how do I, you know, Kawhi in the championship year, for example, was a career high in playmaking. It was like, can he become like a 4, 5, 6 assist guy because of the defensive attention you command? So yeah, there is, like, there's a, hey, this is smart basketball and there's a skill component to it, but there's absolutely, like, a, like, LeBron's dealt with this a ton of, like, making the right basketball play versus you're the star, so that should be your shot. Like, what if Caitlin Clark, like, it comes down to a final possession, even the conference tournament final, you know, she looks off and passes to a teammate and it's the right basketball play and you, you know, surrendered your ego to make that right basketball play. And then the element of, like, what if the right basketball play doesn't work out also?
Yeah. Well, I mean, that's one half of what makes it so compelling. I think the other half too is, like, and you got this quote in here from Jan Jensen in your piece. And the quote was, Caitlin, she's so unabashedly and unapologetically who she is. And so many times women, you second guess, should I do that? Should I do that? Do I need to do this? That's the other part where it's just like, there is none of that with her. At least when she plays, you're like, I don't think she's regretting anything. She's just taking this pull-up 30-footer if that's what she feels like is the right move. She's got enough moxie, enough skill to obviously make those at a high level. But I love the general approach, and I thought that this quote really kind of highlighted it for me. But, yeah, what did you think when you heard that quote?
I mean, it's part of the reason that I was drawn to her, frankly. You know, I just think that she just completely is – when you see her on the floor, she's just not self-conscious at all about what she's doing. And in fact, frankly, like, that level of, you know, I think sometimes, I don't want to generalize too much, but I think sometimes, like, women get socialized to worry so much about what other people think and what they need. And Caitlin Clark, she has been the opposite of that. And she's actually had to learn the other side of it, because it's something that everybody needs to learn, especially in a team concept, right? Like, we all have to be somewhat conscious yes. of what's going on around the people around us and how our actions, our body language, how the way that we treat them impacts them. But she kind of like is in this way of like reverse engineering it, because like for so many women that I know, and so many women, I'm sure you guys know, people in general, like this is like the era of like figuring out why am I such a people pleaser? Why am I always like deferring to other people? Like this like sort of like highly therapized moment that we're in, to like then see somebody like that who is basically the exact opposite, who is going out and basically just staking her claim and saying like, I want to be the greatest. I think I can do it. It's just really inspiring to see. And I think it's part of the reason that, you know, at this point, she's not really seen as the same villain that, you know, for example, JJ Redick was in college, because at a certain point, like that level of arrogance, because of the person that we're seeing from, like because of the fact that she's a woman, just it's charming. And I'm not going to say it's new. I think it's existed in college basketball and in sports for a really long time. But I think that for a number of reasons, it's something that like the mainstream is coming to appreciate about Caitlin Clark, because they love the way that she plays. She's also, I mean, frankly, like, let's be real, she's white, like that is part of it. Like, it's like this sort of like level of transgressiveness that still is in an appropriate place for, like, for example, for Good Morning America to go and then like want to profile her, and she's like a great story. You know what I mean?
I do. Sorry, my mic was off. I mean, there's one thing you said in there that, like, the JJ Redick comp, if she went to Duke, I don't know if I could get there with it. I think that would still be.
It's a big part of it. Yeah. Like, she wants to put Iowa, her home state, on the map. That's obviously a cool part of it.
So I don't mean to intentionally pivot from a woman who's being kind of celebrated and appreciated for some of these things to a woman who is not. But it's possible that Caitlin Clark is going to run into LSU again. And Kim Mulkey has kind of been on the exact opposite end of the spectrum during this March Madness run. And just generally in her presentation, I guess, the way she wants to present to the world.
As a Disney villain?
Yeah. Yeah. Cruella DeVille, but coaching basketball, yeah. You know, like, yeah. It's a lot. And we don't need to get into the whole of everything with the Washington Post. You can Google that and check that out if you don't know what we're talking about. But I know you had some thoughts on Kim Mulkey in general. I know you guys talked about it on the Ringer podcast coming out of the initial March Madness weekend. LSU is still a really good and really compelling basketball team with some flaws that were kind of highlighted in the early parts of this tournament as well. I guess just kind of an overall temperature check from you on LSU and just the degree to which the Kim Mulkey stuff is muddying what was already, I guess, like murky waters for their ability to go on a big run here.
Yeah, I mean, it's the Kim Mulkey playbook, and I'm curious about what will actually come out in that Washington Post story. But for her to go and have like a pre-press conference about it just feels like it's straight out of her playbook, because it does a number of things. A, it raises her profile, it gets a ton of attention on her, which she loves, and it also kind of sets up this situation where I feel like if this story comes out and it's all the things we already know about Kim Mulkey, which is that she is like manipulative and a great actress, and while like at the same time being a great coach, but has like not always treated her players well. We obviously know, like, you know, when Brittany Griner was at Baylor, she, you know, had kind of pressured her to hide her sexuality and didn't really tell her about Baylor's policy around expressions of homosexuality. So she's kind of, you know, she can be two-faced in that way. And then like the second Brittany has left Baylor, it's like she just kind of like washes her hands of her in this way that, you know, if you go and read the book that Griner wrote, like it, and then obviously we know that she didn't comment at all when Brittany Griner was in prison. So this is just like there are a number of examples. Like, there are just so many things that Kim Mulkey has done that shows you that she cares more about her program and how she looks and how, you know, that impacts recruiting more than she cares about her actual players, which is also kind of, I mean, it makes her the quintessential elite college basketball coach. You know, like, great coaches aren't always great leaders or great role models, especially in college basketball, which can be a pretty, you know, even on the women's side, can be a pretty slimy place at times. So, you know, it's just, and to me, it's frankly, like, that's my take on it. I would love to talk about something else, to be honest, because I feel like this is what she wants. She wants, the women's game has never had this much attention, and she wants all that attention on herself.
That makes sense. I mean, it's certainly, yeah, and there's an element as well of tapping in early to the general distrust of the media at this point in time in some circles of the world. So, yeah, it's I agree with you that the attention is a wanted thing. I guess, like, absolute friendliest lens, you could be like, well, she's taking the attention and the pressure off of her players. And it's like, I don't think it has anything to do with anything.
I think Dawn Staley is somebody who does that really well.
Yeah.
Go back to that fight that broke out with LSU in South Carolina. She completely took responsibility. Kim Mulkey, on the other hand, is like, I wish that she would have hit Angel Reese. Like, what? This is the first time that Angel Reese has finally just been not in a play, and you're kind of bringing it back to her. But, you know, to the point of that, like, I think that, and talk about this, I think it is somewhat, it's a strategy. It's us versus them. With yeah. LSU, they have a number of, like, Angel Reese is a very polarizing player as well. Haley Van Lith came, like, transferred to LSU because she wanted to learn from Kim Mulkey, who's also a great point guard in her time. You know, Flaje Johnson, after she had that great game that basically saved LSU in that last night, in my opinion. You know, she promotes her new single, which is I think great. Like, you know, use that spotlight. They have a number of players who, like, know how to deal with being polarizing. They know how to deal with the spotlight. My question is going to be, as you keep on, like, ratcheting up the pressure here, is this going to be fire, or are you, like, playing with fire and it's going to eventually burn you?
That's why people are watching this, honestly.
It
like,
is.
The storylines here are, like, 100 times better than whatever it is in men's basketball right now.
I mean, like, look,
the men's tournament is not compelling. I'm sorry, not even close.
We're 26 minutes into this segment, and the women's side is compelling enough with the Caitlin Clark. And this, like, we haven't even left that one region of the bracket yet. There is a 34-0 team that just, like, more than doubled up an opponent in a second round game yesterday, Battle of the Carolinas. South Carolina went 88-41. Like there is a, hey, potentially the 10th undefeated season of all time. And that's like the third or fourth note down the list. It maybe even a little lower if you want to, you know, focus in on the Canadian players and teams like Connecticut and Gonzaga and stuff like that. I think it speaks to, you know, the depth of this women's tournament, how entertaining it is. I guess, Sierra, this is more of a big picture philosophical, and I know we're running long with you here, but this does not seem like the first time, and it doesn't seem like it's going to be the last time, that the women's side of March Madness feels much more compelling, richer on storylines, richer on personalities than the men's side. You know, the simplistic, like, the reductive explanation is, well, they stay in school a little bit longer, we get to know them a little bit more, there's some of these rivalries built in, but it does feel like more than just that feels like an oversimplification. Why do you think that this is? Because this feels like year two or three that this has happened, and you look ahead to what, you know, the field could look like next year, who the key players are going to be next year. It doesn't seem like it's going to be something that slows down, really.
I just think the game is better than it's ever been. I think that so many more resources have been poured into it. I think you can actually draw, like, a through line, too, between what happened in the COVID bubble with Sedona Prince basically making these TikToks showing the world the disparity between, like, how the NCAA poured resources onto the men's side versus the women's side. And now that has shifted so much, and we're seeing it with the quality of play. And you're also seeing that, like, on the grassroots level as well. Like, the freshmen that have come in this year, like, one person I'll shout out right now, like, Juju Watkins, basically, like, she plays for USC. Very similar sort of mindset as Caitlin Clark in terms of how great she wants to be. When you watch her, you can tell she has that thing. She has that ineffable thing of, like, She is not scared of any moment. Like, I've been trying to figure out, like, who she reminds me of. It's like California Caitlin on a level. She decided to go to USC. She is from Los Angeles, and she wants to bring that program that is storied back to glory. And they are way ahead of schedule. And they could make a real run as well, because she's just, I mean, there's a number of reasons, but a lot of it has to do with the fact that she's just been exceptional. She had a 51-point game against Stanford earlier this season. And then, you know, Stanford basically tried to say, okay, they played in the conference championship, in the last Pac-12 championship. And boy, is that conference going out with a bang right now. They decided we're not going to let you score. And then she finishes with 9 points, but figures out how to get off the ball, make herself a decoy. And there's just no real way to stop her. She's so fun to watch. She's just one freshman, though. But there's Madison Booker and number one seed Texas, who's just been awesome. Where's number 35, incredible Texas freshman, has basically an unstoppable pull-up mid-range jumper. I don't know if that reminds you guys of anybody, but she's really, really fun to watch as well. Like, I kind of look at it like just throw on some jazz, open up a bottle of wine and watch her highlights, because she's just that smooth. And she has turned herself from like a wing into a point guard. And basically, like, you know, as it's like, if you're an NBA fan, I think you'll see this with Juju and with Madison, like this sort of heliocentric style of play, where Madison on some level reminds me of a player like maybe like a Luka Doncic, because she's able to use her size to just basically manipulate space. And she never really, you can't really speed her up. She can see above everybody. She doesn't really, you know, if you pressure her with a trap, she's going to find the right pass. And with Juju, I kind of see like more of like a Carmelo Anthony for the modern era, a modern Maya Moore maybe. And like you add in like a level of defensive intensity that is also pretty rare in a freshman. Those two are awesome. You got Hannah Hidalgo, who's playing as we speak for Notre Dame. And, you know, it's just like there are a number of like really young players right now that I think are going to get the spotlight. Especially, you know, we'll see what happens with Iowa and their tough path as well. So, I think the game's in a great place. I think it's going to keep growing.
There you go.
Yeah.
Good time to bring a WNBA team to Toronto.
Yeah, it would be. I mean, I was going to ask you, you know, you just mentioned a couple freshmen. So maybe we're talking like this is the 2026 draft, 2026, you know, after, because you know what they're going to do to the expansion team. Same thing they did with the Raptors of like, oh, you can't have a number one pick. You can have a high pick. So some names to watch these next couple weeks tonight and then the following 2 weekends. But also keep in mind, yeah, not expansion draft, but however high you're allowed to pick as an expansion team if it goes down that way.
There you go. Sarah, yeah. We appreciate you, and
yeah, appreciate sorry. You guys too. Thanks for having me on.
Yeah, for sure. Anytime, honestly. All right, Sarah Tsohi of The Ringer. I feel like I cut her off at the end. I didn't.
It's all right. There's just like, there's never,
it's my bad, Sarah.
There's never an easy way to say goodbye. Like when you would really like to keep talking to the person, but have already taken up more of their time than you agreed to.
Yeah.
It's always a little tough on the way out, but it's cool.
Give me like, aside from like, okay, you fell out your bracket and this is like a habit, you know, is there something compelling you to watch the men's tournament?
I mean, I still really enjoy this stuff. Like, I think it's in
it's a matter of preference. I'm not saying that there's like, it needs to be a universality in the preference.
No, like storyline wise and how compelling the, you know, especially when we get to the Elite Eight onward,
yeah.
You know, I think the women, I said it when I was asking Sarah there, I think the women's tournament is more compelling right now than the men's. And part of that is, you know,
it was the same thing last year. It was when the numbers came out last year. Like, this is not us saying this. It's like just in general.
Yeah.
The audience is referring.
And some of this is, you know, Coach John Calipari from Kentucky didn't say this in a very good way. Jay Wright said it in a better way. But part of this is, you know, one and done does have an impact, especially in the transfer portal era, where they're like some of the most compelling individual players, especially as us who are coming to this from the NBA perspective. And the first thing I care about is, I'm going to see these guys in the NBA. Yeah. Like this is whetting your appetite for the guys we're going to see next year. Hey, I'm going to learn Cam Whitmore. You know,
get ready to learn Cam Whitmore, buddy.
Yeah. Okay. You know, that's the kind of thing. And what that produces is like, there's an imbalance of the teams that are a little more over indexed to NBA prospects aren't as good come conference tournament time and NCAA tournament time,
right?
Because there are these programs that have, you know, committed long term and have a, you know, a longer term system and vision, and guys are in their third and fourth year and have been through it and things like that. And it's almost, you know, that for a long time, like when we were coming up, was more the staple, right? Like Garrett Temple played on 4 years worth of LSU teams.
Had multiple NBA teammates, had some really, really good teams.
We talked to Big Cat last year, right? And that team that won the national championship in 1998 had gone to the finals and lost in overtime in 1997 and returned a bunch of those guys, even though like six of those guys would eventually go into the NBA. And I don't know what the solution is to that. Like in the NIL era and the transfer portal, you know, the NBA is obviously getting ready to respond to the way things look in some way, canceling the G League Ignite. moving forward.
Right.
Whether that means they might be more open to, hey, guys can come in right out of high school, and we have almost this implicit like baseball style system where it's like you can come out of high school, but if you go to college, you're staying there for a little while because then, you know, that's just what we're going to, like, if we believe in you developmentally, rather than taking you as a freshman, we'll just take you as a high school pick. If you go to college, the implication is you're going to need a couple years there. Now, you're not going to legislate that explicitly. It's too restrictive to players and things like that. But maybe that's what we move toward. Anyway, yes, I still see lots of reasons to view on the men's side.
Okay.
There were some really, really fun games over the weekend. There's always going to be, in the early weekend, the David versus Goliath element.
Yeah.
As you get a little later in the tournament, you know, as
just like, that Uber Eats guy.
Yeah.
Or the DoorDash man.
Bulky, yeah.
Yeah.
And now you're going to get into, you know, okay, Zach Edey's finally made the Sweet 16. Now, as he gets against better teams, what do they do against that? That's one thing,
sure,
if you're the 16 seed trying to game plan against that. Now, how does he react to better teams and things? And then there's always like, you know, the legacy programs that you're interested in seeing.
I guess, yeah.
You know, can Arizona not disappoint me this year? Can UConn repeat? Mm-hmm. This is like UConn graduated a couple guys to the NBA and is bringing back a lot of the championship teams,
right?
After being an underseeded team that goes on a run next year, can they repeat? And there are a lot of things like that that still hook me in addition to the getting eyes on guy for the NBA spot. But I don't think it's as, you know, there is no figure in college basketball, no disrespect to Zach Edey, there's no figure in college basketball as compelling as Caitlin Clark. There's no team in college basketball as compelling as South Carolina's bid to be the 10th undefeated team. You know, and the different points of like, hey, well, UConn's pretty good and has this rich history too. What if they run into one of those teams? What if LSU, who are super interesting on the court and you want to root for them on the court, and then there's the Kim Mulkey dynamic where it's like, can I root for this team? It's like when Kentucky's good and fun or Duke's good and fun. It's like, really? And I know we're going to talk about a couple prospects in the last segment, so I'll save kind of my tongue-in-cheek Duke stuff for there because that's going to come up again. But I think there are still reasons to watch it and be locked in. But also, like, some of this is also inertia of, it's the conference tournament. And yesterday, like, all I did was sit on the couch and watch basketball, both tournaments, but you can kind of, you get like double the court surfing options.
Yeah. I mean, look, yesterday, I'm not going to lie, I did make a wholehearted effort. I'm like, okay, I might as well tune in some college basketball. And then I was like, oh, the Heat are playing the Cavs. And then I switched.
And so that was like, that was a bad Heat Cavs game, wasn't it?
What can I do? I'm like, oh, after this, Timberwolves are going to play whoever they played last night. I don't even remember anymore.
The Warriors. They beat the Warriors last night.
The Warriors game. Yeah. So I was like, I'll tune into that. And then, ooh, Pacers, Lakers. I'm like, you know. But I think the biggest lesson here is, like, the women's side have done a really, really good job establishing and then building, like, personalities that you can really buy into and you can really, like, really follow and understand and appreciate. And I feel like the men's side, especially because of some of the reasons you mentioned, you're not able to invest in the individual storylines as much. And so you're just kind of like going in and trying to buy the whole product. And that's a lot harder to sell rather than like, there is this going on or like, this is happening, this happens. You know what I mean? That's why I asked it from a storyline perspective.
Yeah. And I think you like, there are those storylines that exist, but I think you have to be a more hardcore, more locked in college basketball
exactly,
fan.
Yeah.
Like Daniela could come back on and tell us about some of these, you know, Houston almost getting knocked off. Yesterday, barely fight, like Texas A&M makes this huge comeback in a 1-9 game, could have been a huge upset. And like, you get into Houston, it's like, okay, well, you know, Sharp is not very efficient, but it's year two, he's becoming more of a, anyway, you can get into these things, you can find these things, but they're not as like obvious as on the women's side, which is like, it's a reversal where even in years past, like pre-pandemic, say, there were probably women's tournaments that were better, more exciting, had closer games, better, you know, individual players that would go on to the WNBA or whatever. But the case was always, well, on the women's side, you have to go hunting for those stories. You have to find them. You have to know about them or have someone tell you about them. Whereas it seems to have reversed now where like some, like the key three or four things you're watching for on the women's side are just like, they're obvious and everyone, like I was before Raptors Wizards, on Saturday, I was out with some friends, and these are like sports fan friends, but not friends that I've heard talk about, you know, the WNBA a ton other than like, yo, are we getting a team? That kind of thing. And like, Caitlin Clark was the first point of interest for those people in March Madness, other than like one guy who's a huge UNC fan. It's like, okay, so that has usurped that even for like a casual fan. And like you said, the numbers back that up too.
Well, I mean, look, you offer both quality and like something compelling, like storyline-wise.
Yeah.
women's basketball has both of those right now. And the men's side, I'm like, all right, like, so nothing's really that compelling. And then also quality-wise, if there's also an NBA game on, I think I would have tapped in the NBA. So that, like, what are you holding me for?
And some of that comes down to, like, how much value do we, like, when we're talking about quality, like, obviously NBA players are way better. The game, like, if the game is executed at a higher, it's higher level basketball.
I'm talking not 35-25 at halftime, man.
Right. Some people would say, like, oh, Texas A&M, nearly not like knocking off Houston with this, like they might prefer that from a quality standpoint because like the leverage is so high and the emotion is so high. But yeah, like
I might also like, be a college basketball hater. I'm not
tactically,
gonna lie.
It's not really a question.
No, that's fine. Hey, anyway, we're gonna take a break.
Yeah, talk some prospects on the other side.
Let's do it. You've been listening to the Raptor Show on the Sportside Radio Network, brought to you by Campbell's new Chunky Spicy Soup.
The most opinionated Maple Leaf show out there. Real Kipper and Bourne. Be sure to subscribe and download the show on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to the Raptor Show on the Sportsnet Radio Network. I'm your host, Ben Lou. We got 10 more minutes in the program, so we're going to race through some of these assorted Raptors topics. One thing for Raptor fans to tune into for the college games on the men's side is some prospects, because the Raptors do potentially have three picks in this draft. Blake, I asked you to prepare a couple of, I suppose, are these like, are these deep cuts? What are these deep cuts?
No,
like? Give us the scope and the range of these prospects.
I covered a range. You just asked me prospects in general, not necessarily for the Raptors.
Okay, yeah.
But I had two who were in the range of, or sorry, one who's in the range of the Pacers pick, two in the range of maybe the second round pick, and then a fringe undrafted. Just I try to spread it out, and also the top guys are not that interesting. So, I got a couple for you. And obviously, look, I am swooping in at this point in the college basketball season. I obviously keep up with the news items and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. I've not watched a ton of tape on these guys. In years past, people who know my work know I go into the deep breakdowns on guys and do them a couple at a time. I'm not at this stage yet. These are just guys who popped to me over the weekend.
All right, hit me.
First one is Jared McCain of Duke. This is not an under-the-radar name. ESPN has him ranked 19th right now.
Right.
Dropped a 30-piece on Sunday. Mm-hmm. Generally, I like poking at Duke and don't. Like, it's hard for me to be like, that Duke player is, like, really, really fun. But sure, McCain plays with, like he's a very, like, joyful player. It's a really positive energy watching him.
Yeah.
He's also shot 41% on threes.
He was red hot last time, but he made 7 or something?
Yeah. And, like, he's probably, like, a little undersized as a two guard, mm-hmm. which is why he's not higher up the draft board. Like, you're looking, like, not to go back to the Javon Freeman, Liberty, Jamias Ramsey thing, but he's probably more of a 6'3 two guard than a point guard at this point. But you can hit 41% on threes. You play a really fun style of game. I like that.
Okay.
You teased me before the weekend about liking Marquette. They're a team that's very good defensively. Their offense is solid, but in Daniele's little, hey, these are the only teams that have won a shocker. The guys that I like don't shoot the three well enough to get on the radar. But Tyler Cole looks awesome. Like, he is very, very 21-5-11 yesterday. I'm always going to believe in Marquette guys that they'll find a way at the next level. They're always very, very tough. He's got some size at 6'3" for the point guard position.
Okay.
Has also knocked down 40% of his threes the last 2 years, averaging almost 8 assists per game this year. So again, not a guy who's like completely under the radar. ESPN has him ranked 29th, so kind of a fringy first round pick.
Okay, so maybe for that Pistons pick, yeah.
Yeah, if you're talking about looking at, hey, the Raptors have a hole at backup point guard. Is this a guy who could come in and contribute in a backup point guard role? Maybe. Then you get a little further down. This is either a reach in the second round or you're talking about an undrafted guy. Jalen Bridges took a really nice jump this year as a shooter. He's out of Baylor. Nice jump this year as a shooter at volume. There's some shot versatility, catch and shoot, pull up, off the move, couple different levels there. I think ESPN has him ranked in the late 50s. So you're probably looking at him as hey, could you nudge him to undrafted and get him as a two-way? But the shooting growth looks pretty real in a couple of versatile ways. And then the last one is Nafali Dante, who had a monster game for Oregon in that double overtime loss to Creighton. 28, 20, 3, 2,
Ooh.
And 2. Now he's from
high energy.
So he's an interesting one. He's from Mali. Mm-hmm. He had been on the prospect radar pretty early in high school, where in some of these like prep school events, he was like the youngest player there. But now he's a 5-year player at Oregon. So you see a little bit less of the, you know, hey, maybe there's not a ton of developmental upside. He averages 1.6 assists a game. So he's not a complete non-passer, but he hasn't hit a three. He's a little bit limited defensively on the perimeter from what it looked like. But in terms of a big man who rebounds really well, he shoots almost 70% from the field because he only shoots in the paint, and he plays above the rim pretty well in the paint. I All think right. like he's not ranked in ESPN's top 100 right now. That's a guy where like,
Is he like a seven-footer?
Yeah, close enough to it, if not.
All right.
I forget exactly what he's listed at. He is listed at 6'11".
Okay, yeah.
Cool. And they list him at 210. He's definitely bigger than 210 at this point. So, I don't know. Maybe I just, like, I thought Saga Bakanate, another big man from Mali, right. was going to be a good shot blocker at the next level. Yeah. But, I don't know. You put up 3.6 assists per steal, or blocks plus steals. You shoot really well inside. You play your role really well.
Yeah.
As far as an undrafted free agent, could he be a two-way as a fourth center kind of guy? Could you get him into the G League and see if you could bring the passing parts of the game along a little bit? I don't know. He popped to me as a potential undrafted target.
No, for sure. For sure. I'm going
to... Although, you put up 28 and 20. You probably popped to everyone watching as an undrafted target.
Oh, you know, I think that's the one of the good things now, especially now that the NBA has introduced two-ways and also three two-ways now they expanded. It's like you do get to keep tabs on even more of these type of players. So if that's the way they choose to decide to go... we will see. By the way, do you think the Raptors will bring in three rookies next year? What are the likelihood of
three rookies total? Maybe just because of the two-way slots and stuff like that. Even though two of them are accounted for right now, like I said earlier, teams churn the two ways all the time.
They brought Fred, Pascal, and Jakob in.
Yeah,
one year,
and it's challenging developmentally. But you brought Fred Jakob. Like Fred would have been a two-way if he came along now.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly.
You have some extra flexibility with that. They're also in a situation where they should be skewing younger right now. I would say on the 18-man roster, there's probably three rookies.
Okay,
next year, but like from what Masai had said in the press conference, from talking to people around the org, I'd be a little surprised if the three rookies brought in are the third pick. A top six pick, the Indy pick, and the number 31 pick. You know, this is a team that has more often used one or two picks and then hit the undrafted thing. Mm. It's also like it's a weird one where people don't like the draft very much at all at the top.
Yeah.
But it's a flat draft, so maybe you could get guys undrafted because it's an eye of the beholder kind of draft. Maybe you could get guys undrafted or you could, you know, I don't know. Who knows? They packaged 31 and 18 to get a second. I don't know. There are a lot of scenarios.
They got options. Yeah, they got optionality.
So what I'm trying to say is I think they'll have three rookies on the 18-man roster, but whether those are the three actual draft picks or trades happen with the draft picks and then they end up with a undrafted free agent two-way or whatever, who knows?
Yeah, well... We will focus on the game tonight, finally. The Raptors are playing tonight.
It's time now for Between Lines, brought to you by Bet Rivers. Take a chance. And the Toronto Raptors are playing at home. They're playing a team that's just lost six games in a row. They're playing a team whose star player has friends being like, it's like the sad Squidward meme where Patrick's in the window watching. Patrick's the guy in the window?
Squidward's
in the window. Yeah,
SpongeBob and Patrick are running outside.
Yeah. That's what it is. So Josh Hart saying that about Mikal Bridges. He's just watching everyone else win games. That's how bad a state the Brooklyn Nets are in. They are 6.5-point favorites in Toronto. Raptors will be without Scottie Barnes, RJ Barrett, Emmanuel Quickley, Jakob Poeltl, Jonte Porter, Chris Boucher, and DJ Carton.
But with the injury list, man. That's tough.
I'm going to get on my Weird Al, on the Nets side, Cam Johnson, Ben Simmons, Dennis Smith Jr., Kata Bates-Siop, and Derek Whitehead all out. The Nets have lost six in a row. Since February 1st, they're 26th in offense and 19th in defense.
Man.
The only thing they're above average at really is forcing turnovers.
Okay.
I don't know, man. The Raptors have home games left against Brooklyn and Washington.
Uh-huh.
That's about it for like games that look like potential scheduled W's. How are you feeling?
You know, I'm feeling this conversation that we had with Dennis last time he was on the program, and we said, see you in the play-in. And neither of us are in the play-in right now. The Atlanta Hawks are 8 games under .500, and they have a firm lead over this Brooklyn team. Toronto obviously is not going to be making the play-in.
The Raptors are 8.5 back.
Damn. Yeah, that's tough, man. I think it'll be difficult. I think on paper, I think Brooklyn clearly has a lot more established NBA talent than the Raptors tonight. We've seen the Raptors play scrappy, competitive. I don't mind the losses. I just don't want to see the whole thing bottom out, so the game itself is kind of irrelevant, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So at least keep it close, keep it competitive. Let's see what Grady can do. He's been really strong the last couple of days. I think I really liked Ochai the last couple of games as well. I feel like he's using athleticism a lot better going to the cup.
Kind of. Friday we saw him passing a lot more than we've really seen. I think he had six or seven assists.
He had that beautiful little thread pass. Yeah,
and then Saturday really finishing well around the rim, which has been a challenge for him at times. That was Between the Lines, brought to you by Bet Rivers. Take a chance.
Yeah. Dennis Schroeder, revenge game, potentially. He did get some comments to the German website, Kicker. And he did say, quote, "The team and the coaches welcomed me very well. They gave me a lot of responsibility. I set up multiple plays so I could put my teammates and myself in the spotlight. The people valued me. In Toronto, I had a good feeling when I signed the contract, but their plan for how they wanted to use me as a player changed pretty quickly. I would have liked more communication, but that's the way business works." I guess I'll ask Dennis about that comment later on in the arena. But otherwise, you know, tune into Raptors Nets tonight. So that does it for us today. I've been your host, Willie.
11 a.m. tomorrow, by the way.
Yes, we're back to 11 tomorrow. The Raptors show on the Sportsnet Radio Network, brought to you by Campbell's New Chunky Spicy Soup. Time to get fired up. Big thanks to our guests today, Garrett Temple and Sirit Sohi. And we'll be back tomorrow at 11 a.m.